Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On this Memorial Day, when many of you are ensconced on the deck, or maybe in the kitchen seasoning some chicken for the grill, we're focusing on the home. After all, with gas topping $4 a gallon and airlines charging for everything but water, a lot of folks will be staying home this summer. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Thanks for joining us on this 26th day of May. It is Memorial Day, not Labor Day, but we begin with an effort underway to create the first transatlantic labor union. Britain's biggest union, Unite, is joining forces with United Steelworkers. The details are still being forged, but our Stephen Beard reports from London on the talk so far.
The two unions are planning to merge later this summer. Unite is the larger, with some 2 million members in manufacturing, financial services, healthcare, and the public sector. Together, the two groups will represent almost 3 million workers in the US, Canada, Britain, and the Caribbean. This is just the first step. They're calling on other unions in Asia, Eastern Europe, and Latin America to join them. Derek Simpson is joint head of Unite. He says the move will meet the challenge of globalization.
We have a view that we need a global trade union in order to be able to deal effectively and on a par with the many global companies that we now have members working for.
Some analysts say this could lead to a new era of global labor militancy with cross-border strikes. This may even make it more difficult for some big companies to shift production to cheaper locations abroad. But others find that unlikely. Justin Urquhart-Stewart is a global fund manager based in London. He says unions in the East will hardly want to stop any jobs coming their way.
They'll be wanting to attract jobs, and they want further investment. So I'm afraid that they'll have absolutely nothing in common with the Western unions at all.
He says it's a bit late in the day for Marx's rallying call, "Workers of the World Unite." But officials in the two unions say they're not trying to create a revolution, just pack more of a punch when dealing with powerful multinationals. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Today, environment ministers from the Group of Eight industrialized nations pledged to cut greenhouse gas emissions in half by mid-century. The announcement came after a three-day meeting in Japan, and it represents a major breakthrough for negotiations on a new international climate treaty. But as it often goes with these things, there is a sticking point. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton has that story.
The thinking goes like this. It's not so hard for a politician to agree on huge reductions in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 simply because it's so far away. None of the politicians throwing their weight behind the agreement will still be around when it goes into effect. It's the shorter-term goals, the ones that serve as a roadmap for getting there, that threaten to stall the talks. Dan Kamen is a climate policy expert at UC Berkeley.
The fear of a 2020 target is you have to act now. You would have to not only get the clean energy technologies up and running, but relatively soon there's going to have to be a price for carbon. And that's really where the rubber hits the road. That's where this is going to have a financial cost.
Last year, the UN launched negotiations for a new international climate change treaty to replace the Kyoto Protocol when it expires in 2012. This weekend's meeting was aimed at smoothing the way for more decisive action at July's G8 summit in Japan. But it also created a path for more economic cooperation between industrialized nations and the developing world. The U.S., Britain, and Japan announced a new $5.5 billion fund to help poor nations develop clean technologies. Berkeley's Dan Kamen says that's important because it's one of the fastest ways to reduce emissions.
it takes only a matter of months to a year to install a wind farm or solar thermal plants, whereas it takes many years, and sometimes a decade, to get some of the biggest industrial facilities installed.
And Kamen says there's an added bonus for the countries donating the funds. It's their clean tech firms that are likely to get the business. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Wall Street found itself raked over the coals last week, and so is spending some time in front of the grill today. We'll take a look at the rest of the world markets when we do the numbers. I was growing up way back in the 1970s. For TV entertainment after school, we had Sesame Street, The Electric Company, Mr. Rogers, and there were all those Saturday morning cartoons. At least that's what I hear, since they were verboten in our house. These days, the entertainment choices seem endless. Kids have TiVo and iPods and entire networks dedicated to them, from Disney to Nickelodeon. Variety magazine's Dade Hayes started to pay attention to this rattle battle once he became a dad. And he's written a new book about the children's entertainment industry. It's called Anytime Playdate. Welcome to the program, Dade.
Happy to be here.
I love the story early in the book where you talk about how you made the decision. I don't remember how old your daughter was, but she was still very little. And you decided to co-view with her. Tell us about that and how and why it ended.
Well, they call it co-viewing if you're able to actually, you know, sit on the couch or wherever it is and watch a program with your child and ideally, you know, help guide them through it and interact with your child along with the program. But I really did notice that she was kind of having her own experience, and I just didn't know much about this whole world. So that's when I decided to really investigate it and find out where this stuff comes from. And I wasn't going in with any real agenda except for concern for my daughter and for kids.
Well, you point out that children's entertainment is now a $21 billion business. That is stunning. And it's three times what it was just a decade ago. Now, the old line on that would be that this is not a good thing, that all of this passive entertainment is unhealthy for kids. What did you find?
I was surprised when I really spent a lot of time with producers and executives, and I was surprised and impressed with the degree of professionalism and thoroughness that they treated these things with. I followed one particular show that just premiered in February on Nickelodeon called Ni Hao Kailan, which is Mandarin for Hello, Kailan. It's actually teaching kids Mandarin in the way that Dora the Explorer teaches Spanish. And that show took 4 years to get to the air because they want to get it right. So I don't want to sound like too much of a booster. I found plenty of stuff that was a little distressing.
Certainly, they would not oppose if Ni Hao Kailan all of a sudden, you know, sparked a bunch of kids to go out and buy it on the store shelves.
Well, that's just it. The most cynical among people in this business refer to these TV shows as just 22-minute toy commercials,
yeah.
You know, that they're really just teasers for people to go out and consume these characters in myriad ways. And let's take a step back and think about how ubiquitous Dora is. Let's just use Dora. She's a, you know, a ride at a theme park in Dubai. She's in toys and I mean, you name it, she's on it. And certainly as a parent, I feel a little bit daunted by it. And if you really look at the underpinnings of this business, it's not as carefully controlled as the actual program on television.
I wonder, though, is the marketing of new characters like Dora or, say, the Wiggles, is it any different from what we saw with, say, Cookie Monster and Bert and Ernie and the Mickey Mouse Club, for that matter? I mean, I certainly remember having puppets and other merchandise that was tied to those shows.
You know, it's a very good point. I can even go back another generation. In the book, I look at the sort of godhead of all this stuff, which is Howdy Doody. In the 1950s, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of merchandise were racked up over the course of the 1950s, you know, which you can imagine with inflation how much we're talking about.
As you were finishing the book, you and your wife had a second child, and I wonder if you're planning to do anything differently in terms of his exposure to all of this children's programming.
I have to say I was pretty profoundly affected by my investigation into baby videos. And
I mean, like Baby Einstein?
Baby Einstein and
that sort of thing.
Myriad other baby videos that are out there. That is an area that I still have deep concerns about. I'm all for something with a demonstrable benefit. But when you're talking about, I mean, there are now TV networks, Baby TV and Baby First TV,
jeez,
that are aimed at 3-month-old to 36-month-old kids. And I just feel like that's sort of the final frontier.
Dade Hayes is the author of Anytime Playdate, Inside the Preschool Entertainment Boom, or How Television Became My Baby's Best Friend. Thanks for setting a playdate with us.
Absolutely, Tess. Thanks very much.
We mentioned at the top of the show that we're going to focus on the home. Many of us are spending the holiday in ours. Did you know that the average new house in this country has doubled in size since the 1950s? Well, we wondered what would happen if everybody in the world consumed like the average American family. We sent Marketplace's Sean Cole to find that family.
Because what family could possibly be more average, more consumerific than...
Krusty Burgers!
I'm old! Gimme!
Isn't there anything faster than a microwave?
Bing! Sadly, they're also fictional. I was going to have to find a real family, the real Simpsons. And if you Google the phrase, the real Simpsons, you'll find the website of Dan Simpson.
Well, come on in, Sean.
Hey, folks.
This is my family.
He lives about 25 miles outside L.A. with his wife, Dina, and their daughters, Anna and Krista.
Or also known as Marge, Lisa, and Maggie.
There's a Bart, too, Dan's son, Micah, who's in Hawaii now. Anna goes to a local college. Krista's still in high school. And just like Lisa on the show, she plays the saxophone. Which is probably what sold me on them. Even though Dan kept telling me over and over before my visit, we're not really your average consumers.
This is our humble little abode. It's not.
Dan showed me around while my colleague, Joellen Easton, asked the other Simpsons about their consuming habits.
Well, we're about halfway through, so it won't take too much longer.
The survey basically helps her estimate how many acres worth of the Earth's resources a given person consumes. It's broken up into 4 main categories. Number 1.
Oh, it's great to be indoors with my family.
Housing.
How big is your house?
A little less than 1,000 square feet.
About half the size of the average new house in this country. So the real Simpsons use a lot less fuel and electricity than the average American. Dina says back in April, all of their utilities combined cost only $84.
Some people say that their electric alone is over 100. I go, how do you do that? Ours is 30. Mm-hmm. So they must really have a lot of electrical stuff or waste.
And waste is not what these Simpsons are about. They make a point of living modestly, mainly because they're devout Christians. Dan works at a Pentecostal church in L.A. proper. Which brings us to category 2, transportation. Remember the episode where the Simpsons tried out that SUV, the Canyon Arrow?
The Federal Highway Commission has ruled the Canyon Arrow unsafe for highway or city driving. Canyon
Arrow. Well, the real Simpsons were driving the Canyonair No.
That little Ford Escort is our car.
Oh, if there's no traffic, Dan can drive to work in 35 minutes. But he doesn't. He spends at least 3 hours a day commuting on buses and trains. It's his downtime, he says.
So I like it. Plus, I'm able to keep a car off the road, which for me is a good value when it comes to global warming, all those things.
So that's important to you?
It is.
Dina works at the elementary school 7 minutes up the road by foot. So between errands and taking the girls to school, they clock maybe 260 miles on the car a month, about a quarter of the national average.
Can I take your order?
Number 3 on the survey, food.
Shall we have dinner?
This isn't just about how much you eat. Meat and packaged food, and eating out a lot, use up more resources than, say, making a taco salad at home.
There's sour cream in.
Though every Sunday, after church, the real Simpsons head to a local Mexican restaurant. Or LA's famous In-N-Out Burger.
Mm-hmm. I don't prefer In-N-Out because I like my burgers flame broiled.
It strikes me that y'all are actually more like the Flanderses than the Simpsons.
Dan didn't take kindly to that. He says the neighbors of the TV Simpsons give Christians a bad name. Still, the real Simpsons love the fake Simpsons. They love TV in general, and movies, DVDs. Which brings us to the last category, goods and services.
When something breaks, do you try to fix it?
They do usually try to fix it, except maybe where home entertainment is concerned.
We have, in our household, a television and DVD player in every room. And if one of them is broken, it gets replaced. Soon, immediately.
Which might be the only average-ish thing about them. Still, when my colleague Joellen crunched the survey numbers, the results were kind of startling. If everyone on the planet lived like the average person in this house, it would take about 3 planet Earths to sustain our population.
What more can we give up?
This is Marge.
I mean...
Dina.
I walk to work. We live in a teeny tiny house. We don't have central heating or air.
And yet their modest way of life, extrapolated across the population of the globe, would ultimately consume the globe. Because a lot of their consuming is done for them by utility companies and transport lines and just the demands of a normal American life. Still, the real Simpsons are doing pretty well. If everyone in the world consumed like the average American, we'd need about 6 Earths to sustain ourselves.
The way people act around here, you'd think the streets were paved with gold.
They are.
I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Coming up, finding a new cubby for your kitty.
People didn't really have any choices. I mean, you're still spending a lot for an eyesore.
But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets are closed for Memorial Day, but economic troubles here caused investor jitters elsewhere in the world. Last week's losses on Wall Street, plus the high price of oil, sent Asian stocks tumbling today. Tokyo's benchmark Nikkei fell 322 points to end at 13,690. Shanghai's composite index dropped 108 points to wrap up with 3,364. And the price of crude is still hovering above $133 a barrel today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, serving their audit, tax, and advisory clients worldwide with people who love what they do. Online at grantthornton.com. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. The Society of Wetland Scientists continues its 29th annual meeting. The Association of International Educators kicks off their annual conference in Washington, D.C. And on this day in 1937, the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, California opened. It was the longest suspension bridge in history. Now the Pearl Bridge in Japan holds that honor. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. It's clear from the real estate wreckage that a lot of homeowners asked for and got mortgages that they could not afford. But as anyone who's been through the process will tell you, even with all the online calculators out there promising to figure out what your bank account can tolerate, it's still something of a crapshoot. Commentator Dan Ariely is in the market, and this MIT professor doesn't have any more of a clue than the rest of us.
My wife and I are currently house hunting. So we've been thinking about how difficult it is to calculate the optimal amount of money we should spend on a house and how much of it we should take as a mortgage. To work this out, we need to take into account our current income, our expected future income, our predictions for the stock market and the housing market, and the interest rate of mortgages today and in the future. On top of that, we need to consider the amount of happiness different houses will provide us, and how will that level of happiness measure up against the lifetime cost of these homes? 41 years of education between us does not seem to be enough to figure this out. Standard economics assume that we'll always act in a way that serves our best interest. But it's very difficult for us to calculate what's in our best interest in terms of home purchasing. So, how can we be sure that our decision will maximize our welfare? Calculating the right amount we should be spending and borrowing is so complex, and banks don't do much these days to help us determine how much we should borrow. So what did we do? We realized that figuring this out rationally was a lost cause. So we relied on some simple but arbitrary factors. We picked a neighborhood that we liked a lot. We found a house that we liked the most within this neighborhood. Then we offered to buy it for $10,000 less than the asking price. I think that the owners of that house could have asked for $100,000 more or $100,000 less than their current price, and we would have still offered them just a bit less than their asking price. The problem is that we just have no idea how much this house is worth to us. We don't know how to translate the pleasure we expect to get from it to the amount we're willing to pay for it. And if the sellers accept our offer, we still have to decide how much to borrow and get a mortgage. This ordeal is clearly not a rational decision-making process, but at least we are now closer to having a home.
Dan Ariely teaches behavioral economics at MIT. His new book is called Predictably Irrational. Dan maybe still be searching for his dream home, but we talked to another couple recently as they moved into their new home in Santa Clarita, California. They were looking forward to stepping over their own threshold after living in a Burbank apartment since 2002.
The kitchen's tiny. It's really hot in the summer, really cold in the winter. Yeah, I seriously didn't think we could last here for 6 years. That's pretty amazing to me.
But we did. That shows that our marriage is good.
My name is Richard Lee, and I'm a project manager at UCLA.
My name is Judy Lee, and I'm a graphic designer. I think in the early 2000s, few of our friends were able to buy a place, and we briefly thought about it and realized that, you know, we needed to pay off some of our debt first, and was hoping that in a couple of years we would be able to buy, but then the housing market just went crazy, going, you know, straight up. And for us, you know, buying a $500,000 house at that time didn't seem like a very wise decision.
We were just kind of tired of renting, and we just wanted to have our own place, and we were just hoping for the right time, you know, when we could actually possibly buy a home.
All the books say that the bottom will reach, you know, the summer or the end of 2008, but our real estate agent said, well, you can wait in the summer, but there will be a lot of families with children who will start looking then as well, because they all want to move before school starts. And, you know, at first I thought it was just kind of a sales tactic, like, you got to buy now, you got to buy now, or else you're going to miss your chance kind of a thing. But I think talking to a couple of our friends who do have children, I realized that there probably is going to be a lot more buyers this summer. So for us, it just made sense that if we found a great home for a good price, that we should buy as soon as possible.
We actually considered the market and some of the news reports and market reports that we were hearing. And even if the market were to drop and hit rock bottom maybe 2-3 years down the road, then, you know, we'll just stay. We weren't looking to flip the house or that type of thing. And we weren't really interested in that. We wanted to buy a home and we want to stay.
And I think that there's so much past emphasis on, you know, value of the home and increasing value or lowering value. And so many people have made so much money off of these homes in California. But really, our basic reasons are very foundational, which is we want to just have a home where we could hopefully start a family. And if it takes 10 years, then we'll be fine. And a lot of the people who are pushed out, that's all they really want, is to be able to live in a home. And they're not so worried about, oh, is the value going to drop within the next year or the next 2 years? Because if they're thinking long term, if they're thinking 5, 10, 15 years, then eventually the housing market will go back up and become normal again.
Richard and Judy Lee speaking with us on their moving day in April. Oh, All right, enough with the joys of home ownership. What if you didn't have to pay a mortgage at all? You could just live in a place where all you had to do was look cute and you could stay for free. It's what you might call a cat's life. And it's gone designer. From KPBS in San Diego, Andrew Phelps scratches out the story.
Elizabeth Page Smith lives and works in Venice, one of LA's funky beach neighborhoods. Inside her atelier, the artist shows me her couchette.
Couchette's a double-sided chaise. Basically, it provides a chaise on one side and then a sort of a cave-like curvilinear space on the underside for the cats to crawl and hide under there and play hide-and-go-seek.
Smith is the creator of Kitty Pod, designer cat furniture. Each piece is made of dense, high-grade cardboard. Kitties love to dig their claws into it. Humans love the curvy shapes and sometimes confuse them with chairs. Smith created Kitty Pod 10 years ago because everything else looked cheap, but wasn't.
People didn't really have any choices. I mean, you're still spending a lot for an eyesore.
Take the classy Kitty Deluxe cat tree for $170 at Petco. It's a couple of cat caves with a giant scratching post stuck on top. And it comes in one style, beige carpet. Compare that to one of Smith's pieces. They can fetch up to $320, but they're seductive, like an egg-shaped capsule with soft cascading ridges. Smith won't say how many she makes, but demand is so high that she now has the pieces die-cut at a local factory.
Well, you start to add up the number of boxes and the time it takes to cut them and refine them and glue them, and, you know, it really adds up. I don't find that churning out these by the bazillions is really my interest.
Of course, Smith says cats like Kitty Pod, too. She tries out the designs on her own cat.
Oh, he loves it. He likes all the Kitty Pod stuff, but he also still loves to attack my other furniture, so...
Smith guarantees her pieces last the life of the cat, but she can't guarantee Kitty won't finish off your favorite leather chair. If that's what your cat prefers, you can always recycle Kitty Pod. I'm Andrew Phelps for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, if you crack open a cold Budweiser today, ponder the idea that the American brewing icon could someday be brought to you by Belgium. The European beer giant InBev is mulling an unsolicited $46 billion bid for Anheuser-Busch. A deal would pour together the world's second and third largest brewers. InBev already owns Stella Artois and Beck's, among other brews. Budweiser and Bud Light are the best-selling beer brands in the world. There's word of a possible hostile takeover bid if Anheuser-Busch decides not to raise its glass to a friendly offer. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. The markets were closed for the Memorial Day holiday. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, hunting for talent on the web.
What if everything you ever wanted came in a rocket car?
Power Thirst! Rocket Edition!
Don't worry, we'll explain. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow, and enjoy your holiday.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.